all the guys in the orange suits and clipboards and hard hats in the world are not going to clean up a major offshore oil spill.
As the 25th anniversary approaches, environmentalists offer lessons learned from the Exxon Valdez disaster. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 20th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the State House passes a resolution supporting the proposed road from King Cove to Cold Bay.
And I hope that we will continue this unanimous support for the people of King Cove.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through PicClickGive or contributing to a college savings plan. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Registration is open for the Alaska Trails 2014 Trails Conference, April 24th through 26th in Anchorage. Agenda and more information at alaska-trails.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Trails.
25 years ago today, Alaska was about to mark the anniversary of the 1964 earthquake, and unknown to all was less than 4 days away from its next big disaster, the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Today in Washington, environmentalists who've been dealing with the spill and its political effects met to publicize what they say are the lessons of the Exxon Valdez. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
It was a media event, but at times it felt like a class reunion if one were held at a funeral home. David Grimes, a prominent fisherman in Cordova at the time of the spill, spoke in spiritual terms.
Incredibly powerfully symbolic. Took place 25 years ago on Good Friday, in the myth, the day of sacrifice.
Grimes says animals gave up their lives in North Slope Crude, and through that, other parts of Alaska were saved. The spill pulled Congress back from the verge of opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. It also preserved acres of forest, because the government used settlement money from Exxon to buy land and logging rights. Marine biologist Rick Steiner, a fixture of spill news in the 1990s, is now an international oil spill consultant. Steiner says using settlement funds to protect habitat from other industrial damage is a positive lesson from Prince William Sound, one that he says applies to spills everywhere.
And that's been one of the sublime silver linings in the whole dark cloud of Exxon Valdez, to be honest with you.
The Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council labels most of the species it's tracking as recovered or recovering. Steiner put it another way. Most of the populations are still not fully recovered. Steiner says a big lesson from the Valdez is there's just no cleaning up from a marine spill. Once oil hits the ocean, Steiner says, it's game over. And it's not a question of money.
All the guys in the orange suits and clipboards and hard hats in the world are not going to clean up a major offshore oil spill. It just won't happen. What we need to do is prevent them.
He and other environmentalists at the event say the risks of a catastrophic spill are so great that the U.S. shouldn't allow drilling off sensitive coasts at all, particularly in the Arctic Ocean. Adrian Herrera, head of the Arctic Power Lobby in D.C., says no one wants to prevent a spill more than the oil industry. But the nation still needs oil, and Herrera says it's better to get it from a well-regulated place like Alaska.
The answer is mitigation and in putting in place responsible and the strictest rules possible to allow this to happen safely.
The environmentalists, on the other hand, say broken promises are another legacy of the Exxon Valdez. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Despite all the fuss over the Save Our Salmon initiative that passed by a narrow vote of Lake and Peninsula Borough voters in 2011, that law is now officially null and void. That's on account of a ruling from Superior Court Judge John Sudduck following a three-year-long lawsuit brought by Pebble and the state of Alaska. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Pebble and the state of Alaska filed separate lawsuits even before the contentious ballot measure went to the polls in 2011, but Judge John Sudduck deferred judgment until after the election. You may recall that when it went to the polls that year, it passed by just 37 votes. Who voted in that election was itself the subject of a lawsuit, But putting that aside, when the initiative passed, it became law in Lake and Penn until Judge Suttock's ruling Wednesday. Here's attorney Matt Singer from the law firm Germain, Dunnigan & Owens, which represents Pebble.
In the conclusion of his decision, he wrote that he was enjoining the enforcement of the SOS initiative. In plain language, that means the initiative is void. It was never passed.
Judge Suttock's 29-page ruling takes a few steps backwards at first, examining Pebble's expected size and potential impacts, the details of which prompted opponents to try and stop its development. In 2008, a statewide effort to do so, known as the Alaska Clean Water Act, was soundly defeated at the polls, so the 2011 SOS initiative focused on the borough only. It added a separate borough-specific permitting requirement that both the plaintiffs and the defendants agreed would be co-equal with the state's permits for the mine. Their lawsuits now merged as one. What Pebble and the state of Alaska argued was that the SOS-required permitting superseded the legislature's constitutional authority.
You know, we have a constitutional mandate to responsibly manage our natural resources. And under the Constitution, the legislature has adopted a robust permitting process through the Department of Natural Resources. And what the judge held is that is the process for determining whether or not a mine should be developed.
Judge Suttock wrote that the SOS initiative goes beyond, quote, simply tailoring mining processes under the borough's land use authority. It instead forecloses the state's due exercise of its natural resources, end quote. He went on to say that granting the kind of power implied under SOS to local governments would balkanize the state's natural resources policy. As an anecdote, Singer says, imagine if any one community along the pipeline passed an ordinance outlawing the pipeline in town.
That would, could potentially cut off the funding that runs our entire state. Again, we all, as Alaskans, we all have an interest in the responsible management of natural resources, not just mine, but of oil and gas and fish and all the rest. And so I think what the judge recognized here is we don't want statewide resources to be regulated and dictated by one special interest group in one part of the state.
The Bob Gillum-backed sponsors of the SOS initiative were predictably disappointed with the ruling. In a written statement, attorney Scott Kendall said the purpose of the initiative was to provide local voices a seat at the table discussing permitting for mines like Pebble and Bristol Bay. That's a role, they argue, they don't otherwise have. Kendall says the sponsors strongly disagree with Judge Suttock's ruling and may appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The Sitka herring fishery saw its first opening this afternoon, starting with the countdown.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, open. The Sitka Sound Sacro Fishery is now open. The Sitka Sound Sacro Fishery is now open. This is the Department of Fish and Game, standing by Channel 10.
That was the voice of fish and game biologist Dave Gordon declaring the fishery open at 1:45 today. The opening lasted 2 hours and 35 minutes. The department estimates the fleet caught at least 4,000 tons of herring, so there will be no opening tomorrow to let the processors work through the catch. The total harvest level for this year is over 16,000 tons. There are 48 permit holders in the lucrative seine fishery. People lined Halibut Point Road near Sitka's ferry terminal to watch the action through binoculars and cameras as the fishery unfolded in front of them and spotter planes circled overhead. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an effort to erase the stigma of mental illness.
Talking about mental illness is difficult. You know, people look at me now and say, really? You were that sick? And I go, yeah.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
The Alaska House of Representatives passed a resolution Tuesday calling for the U.S. Department of the Interior to reverse course and allow a road to be built between the Alaska Peninsula communities of King Cove and Cold Bay for safety reasons. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The main sponsor of House Joint Resolution 30 is Representative Bob Herron from Bethel. He believes last year's decision to not allow the road to be built didn't adequately factor in the public safety of the residents of King Cove, and he asked his colleagues to once again send a unanimous message to the federal government.
And I hope that we will continue this unanimous support for the people of King Cove.
Back in 2010, the Alaska legislature unanimously passed enabling legislation to allow the proposed land deal. That came on the heels of federal legislation that spelled out many of the details of the proposed road between King Cove and Cold Bay. At the heart of the issue is the fact that due to weather, the airport in King Cove can't be used about 100 days a year. If there is a road, then those needing emergency medical care could be taken to the all-weather airport in Cold Bay for transport to medical facilities in Anchorage or other areas. The most impassioned speech during Tuesday's House floor session came from Representative Ben Nagyak, who repeatedly took the federal government to task for their actions in Alaska, and he claimed that the feds are treating the Alaska Native people, including the Native people of King Cove, as children.
The federal government doesn't know what right things are for us. We determine who, what the right things are. Not only the people in our lands, but the people in the state of Alaska. I'm tired of all this stuff that happens by the federal government. I'm tired of it. I'm not a child anymore.
The proposed road from King Cove to Cold Bay would have to go through the pristine Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Most of the refuge was designated wilderness in 1980 under the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. Such a designation greatly limits development within the refuge. That doesn't matter to Representative Tammy Wilson.
It's going to take a bulldozer to make a path. We don't need a road. Make it a path. But seriously, it is our responsibility to take care of our residents. It is not the responsibility of the federal government to do it. And, you know, I would be happy to find some volunteers. I think all of us could find a couple of volunteers.
In the end, House Joint Resolution 30 was passed unanimously by the Alaska House of Representatives. It has been sent to the Alaska Senate for consideration. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
University of Alaska President Pat Gamble told a Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday a reworked bill that would permit concealed handguns on campus is still unacceptable. Gamble said the university faces legal and practical issues, noting that the Supreme Court allows safety-related exceptions to the Second Amendment right to bear arms, like those the state of Alaska has enacted.
How do you map the state law with its concerns over onto a university community which has many of the exact same conditions that are listed and articulated in those state exceptions, such as K through 12 students, such as around a place serving liquor, such as in a residence without the permission of the chief resident? That's the dilemma for us.
The revised version of Senate Bill 176 would allow students 21 and over who get a concealed carry permit and keep guns locked up when not in their possession to have them on campus, including in their dorm rooms. Gamble said 60% of university students are minors, and instituting the gun law would be challenging.
University of Colorado tried to solve that problem by saying, okay, permit carrying 21-year-olds can live in a gun dorm. Nobody's signing up for the gun dorm. You can see that the consequences of how we try to move into these exceptions and create a living space for people to be able to carry create unintended consequences.
Gamble pointed out that the university is uniquely responsible for implementation of gun policy and legal consequences of it. Bill sponsor Senator John Coghill of North Pole said he understands that, but he said people don't check their rights at a university door and emphasized that he's not giving up on the campus gun bill.
Our government was predicated on that people are individually free and governments are supposed to be limited, and there has to be reasons for limitations on individuals. And we're starting down that discussion.
Several students waited to testify on Senate Bill 176 did not get a chance to address the committee yesterday due to time constraints. Coghill said the bill will be considered again on Friday. Yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the death of VPSO Thomas Maydole, and the community of Manicotac honored him on that day. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
March 19 marks the tragic day when in 2013, 54-year-old Maydole was shot and killed in the line of duty while responding to an incident. His death sparked a legislative movement to arm VPSOs across Alaska, but yesterday in Manicotac, the residents remembered the difference he made in their community. Menakutek City Administrator Nancy George.
When VPSO Madolo was hired, in a short period of time, he had a great impact to this organization, to the community, to the elders, to the school students. His service as a VPSO in our community impacted all community members, young and old.
Madol was known to put extra effort into serving his community, and George says he would do extra patrols in the village, rarely took days off, provided transportation to pedestrians, and regularly showed up at school to verbally encourage the students. For these and other valued services, Menakutek took the anniversary of his passing to honor and celebrate the life of their beloved VPSO.
The community of Menakutek is encouraged to take a moment of silence at this hour from 3:30 to 4:30, saluting our fallen VPSO.
The post office and the school in Menakutek hung their flags half-staff in commemoration. All of the city office employees were excused early. Also, their church held a memorial service in the evening. And the residents are looking forward to a Thomas Madol Memorial Basketball Tournament later this weekend. Meanwhile, Alaska House unanimously passed House Bill 199, which would arm VPSOs. If the bill is signed into law, he will forever have made a difference throughout the state. Reporting for KYUK in Bethel, this is Charles Enoch.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The BLM has released a draft supplemental environmental impact statement, which analyzes impacts from the Greater Moose's Tooth 1 project of the NPRA, including construction and operation of a drill site, access road, and pipelines. A 60-day public comment period closes on April 22nd. BLM will hold public meetings and take comments in Fairbanks on March 19th and Anchorage on March 20th. Go to BLM's website at blm.gov/ak for more information. This message is sponsored by the Bureau of Land Management.
If Nome wants geothermal power, the city has to decide by next week if and how it is going to pay for that energy. Pilgrim Geothermal began exploring the geothermal energy at Pilgrim Hot Springs 4 years ago. The company wants to build a power plant on site and sell the energy to Nome. To continue investing in the project, the company needs a purchasing commitment from the city. The contract has not been finalized, but the terms are 20 years of power at 25 cents per kilowatt hour. Nome residents currently pay 21 cents per kilowatt hour for diesel power. Nome would only pay for power if the plant generates an average of 2 megawatts of electric energy. Howard Trott is the managing director for Pilgrim Geothermal LLC. He told the Nome Joint Utility Board Tuesday, his company is committed to generating that amount.
We're highly motivated to make sure we always deliver power to you because we don't get paid without it.
Trott says the company would like to begin selling power to Nome by the end of 2014. There's just one hitch. The company has not located the fracture at Pilgrim Hot Springs that can produce 2 megawatts. But Trott says the company has narrowed the area to where they think that hotspot might be. And Trott wants to begin drilling next month to find it. To proceed, the company needs to secure Nome as a paying customer. Mental illness is usually a personal matter, the type of sickness that doesn't receive much attention. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, wants to change that. After several years without an organized presence in the state capitol building, NAMI advocates spent this week in Juneau sharing firsthand accounts of living with mental illness. During a panel discussion Wednesday, they turned extremely personal matters into public ones. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports.
When Brandon Williams was in his early teens, his mother was diagnosed with severe bipolar disorder.
When you have a mom with bipolar disorder, you don't always know which mom you're going to get. You know, sometimes you're going to get the mom that's on top of the world, ready to conquer everything. What school assignments do you have? Let's knock them out. And sometimes you get the mom that's just so low and inconsolable that there's, you know, nothing that can bring her out of it.
After numerous visits to the doctor, which didn't fix anything, his mother eventually found the resources and services that started to help.
She found NAMI, where she found peer support, where she found people that understood and that she could actually talk to about what she was going through without being isolated or ashamed or alone, which was life-changing and revolutionary.
NAMI specializes in peer-driven support and education. Groups and programs are led by trained individuals who have experienced mental illness or family members of people who have experienced mental illness. Through a combination of NAMI resources and medication, William says his mother recovered.
My mom finally got to a place where she was someone that was completely controlled by her illness to having complete control over her illness. Our family didn't fall apart.
Williams is an adult now. He's the training and development manager for NAMI Anchorage. His mother, Francine Harbor, is the executive director.
Talking about mental illness is difficult. You know, people look at me now and say, really? You were that sick? And I go, yeah.
Harbor says state grants are crucial to making mental health treatment available. The problem, she says, is most legislators don't often hear from people suffering from mental illness.
Because of the stigma, most people who have experienced recovery don't want to come out and say it because they don't want to be associated with that past.
Psychologist and NAMI Anchorage president Pam Robinson says mental illness is just like any other physical illness, like cancer or diabetes, but it's not looked upon that way. Robinson recalls the reaction when two people close to her were hospitalized.
One person was hospitalized with cancer. The other person was hospitalized with a mental illness. The person with cancer, I had almost too much support. I had to thank people and say, please, no more casseroles. I have no room in my refrigerator. And I was so grateful for all of that. Not so much with a person diagnosed with mental illness. We call mental illness the no casserole illness.
Susan Bogley is a pastor at Aldersgate United Methodist Church in Juneau. She says she isn't afraid of the stigma and made the decision to out herself.
I am bipolar. I've suffered from depression since I was a teenager. So I'm here in front of all of you and saying, yes, I am a leader, a spiritual leader in the community, and I do too suffer from mental illness.
Bogley doesn't consider herself recovered, but through the support of her family and NAMI resources, she's managing her illness. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Suicide rates in Alaska communities are some of the highest in the country. Last weekend, the One People Canoe Society held a two-day paddle-making workshop in Wrangell. As part of the workshop, participants attended a behavioral health course on suicide prevention. Its goal is to bring communities together to both learn a traditional art and talk about a contemporary problem. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver has the story.
Around 15 people are hard at work in the high school shop class, sawing, sanding, and shaping paddles. What started off as rough yellow cedar boards are slowly turning into streamlined paddles. The One People Canoe Society puts on workshops like this throughout Southeast Alaska. Brian and Michael Chilton make their way around the panhandle, teaching communities the art of paddle making. Michael says he decided to learn more about the craft after one particular trip he made.
It was really inspiring when we started traveling down to Washington. They have a canoe journey that they do down there. And once we saw, you know, how much people are actually involved and know about their own culture down there, and said, why don't we do that in Juneau?
His uncle, Brian Chilton, has been carving paddles since the early 1990s and painting them for even longer. And now he passes on that knowledge.
You know, we travel all over. You know, different places, different towns, different villages, Angoon, Cape, Wrangell, POW, Ketchikan. I think we're going to do a total of, a dozen paddle workshops. And this is to help them, the local, you know, canoe groups, make their own paddles. And we're actually going to use them to paddle to Juneau for, it's called the Paddle to Celebration.
But these paddle workshops are a forum for more than just woodcraft. They're sponsored in part by a behavioral health grant from the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH. The grant funds presenters that attend the workshops and give condensed courses on suicide awareness and prevention. Alicia Chilton is a board member for the Canoe Society. She says the partnership began a few years ago.
search suicide one is too many, had a canoe. And so we started working together in preparation for the Paso de Celebration 2012. Over the years, our relationships have just grown, and we think it's important with the high suicide rates that we have here, especially in Alaska and in our southeast communities.
Participants in the paddle workshop spend an hour each day away from the bandsaws and sanders in a quiet classroom. Carla Mahosky does youth suicide prevention training for Search.
Part of our grant's mission is to try and decrease the stigma associated with seeking mental health help.
She shows slides with possible warning signs that a person is having suicidal thoughts. She asks the room questions like, "What would you say if a friend told you they were thinking about suicide?" And at the end of the day, there's a quiz. She hopes her students feel more confident about finding resources in the future.
I hope that they, if they see a person in need, that they're able to go help them and refer them to someone to get the professional help if that's needed.
Participants leave the class with keychains and business cards, which they put into their pockets before going back to making paddles. This melding of tradition and prevention is a natural one. They both deal with fulfillment and communication. Again, Alicia Chilton.
You know, but with the paddle workshops or the canoe journeys, it provides a level of enthusiasm that comes with learning about their culture, their native culture, and wanting to get involved. And also the awareness parts. You know, there's unfortunately people have friends that have attempted suicide or that have committed suicide, and it's a big impact on the community.
And bringing the community together is the reason Michael Chilton travels around, helping people carve cedar boards into beautiful paddles that they'll use to perhaps make the journey of a lifetime.
It's actually really important to me because it keeps the culture alive, it keeps the passion alive, and not just in myself, though. It's, you know, I get to help people keep passion as far as their culture goes, all over Southeast Alaska.
He says it's all about transformation for both paddles and people. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger and Mike Mason in Dillingham, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Charles Enoch in Bethel, Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Over 800 Alaskans are diagnosed with serious brain injuries each year. 150 will die from their injuries. A variety of activities such as snow machining, riding ATVs, and playing sports carry risks of brain injury or concussion. Prevention, diagnosis, and treatment are important. Safety is a way of life. Think ahead. Protect your brain. Learn more at alaskabraininjury.net. This message brought to you by the Alaska Brain Injury Network.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.